So this will be about dynamics of rupture through branched and offset fault systems. This is a report from a very group effort, and we were blessed with very many brilliant students, graduate students, and visitors, and postdocs. And the questions we were wanting to ask were the following. How the earthquake rupture chooses its path through geometric complexities like bends, branches, and stepovers? And when and why a fault branch might be preferred? Would the rupture continue as well along the main fault? So we have the view, of course, that straight ruptures do not go forever. The important next question is, could the directivity of a complex earthquake be inferred from a pattern of fault branches it ruptured? I shall basically try to cover these two topics and maybe just go very briefly on other questions, touch on other questions. How do small fault branches interact with the main rupture propagation? Could they arrest rupture? How they contribute to seismic radiation? What is the off-fault damage pattern related to super shear versus sub-Rayleigh rupture propagation? And can laboratory experiments be used to constrain branching theory? But basically, I shall talk about these two points. So here is what the real earthquakes do. This is Denali. This is Denali 7.9 rupture in Alaska. It started in a very complex way here. It propagated along a fault, Denali fault, for quite a distance. Here you have the scale. This is 100 kilometers. So the total rupture is around 350 kilometers. And here there was a possibility of continuation of Denali fault on Denali fault. It was available, but instead the rupture went, branched on Tochunda fault and progressed for almost 80 kilometers along Tochunda. So the question is why it did that. The stress field in this in this area is more or less under quite high angle towards the fault. This is as maximum drawn here. We will get back to that. This is California and Nevada with very many faults and very many complex systems. We will look briefly at part of what Lander's earthquake did. It started kind of here on Johnson Valley. It progressed almost north along Johnson Valley fault. It did branch on Kickapoo fault here, this is Kickapoo, and then it actually backward branched along southern end of Homestead Valley, and then it did continue and did many, many stepovers and branches, etc. It was quite complex earthquake. So here it is in slighter close-up what it did. Where we will be looking more closely. So this is Johnson Valley. It is right lateral strike slip earthquake. It did continue a little bit 4 kilometers along Johnson Valley. Then it died. And here is the branch along Kickapoo. Here we think it jumped to Homestead Valley, back branched along Homestead Valley south, and then went up, etc. So we are interested in these things, why mechanically earthquakes do such things, like branching, jumping, and backward branching. Here are other earthquakes. This is Trust earthquake, San Fernando 71. It started on pretty steep fault. It is steep direction to the more or less horizontal maximum stress. And then at some depth, around 5 kilometers, it went on that branch. Now, here is another Trust earthquake, Cattleman Hills, 85. It did start kind of here, and what we know is it went along that fault. It's not sure, these other faults here are known from seismic reflection, but it's not sure if they did participate in the dynamic process of that earthquake. But what we see, there is a bunch of aftershocks here, so possibly they did. But anyway, what is different to this situation, that fault, that original fault, was having pretty low angle. by comparison with the maximum of stress field here. And as you see, that rupture went, well, let us say, to the right, to the extensional side. And that rupture, rather, if it did go, it went to compressional side. And the difference is these are these different angles between the between the maximum stress field and the fault surface. Now, here we looked at that, and in the point of branching on Kickapoo, this direction of stress field is more or less at 60 degrees to Johnson Valley, so it is kind of steep angle with the fault. The stress field is taken direction from Hardebeck and Hauksson. And here is Imperial Valley, which started south of the border with Mexico and went along Imperial Valley, but did branch along Browley fault zone, and the direction of stress field here is not well constrained, but it's more or less south-north. Now is my favorite case. This is subduction earthquake. It's from Tonankai, 1944, Japan. And so this was a, this is a picture from Park and others. And the structure is known from seismic reflection profiles. What you could see here is that this is the seismic, this is the seismogenic zone on which the subduction earthquake happened. But then here is the continuation of the top of the downgoing slab. But here is a splay fault, which is very well visible on different seismic profiles for actually 100, it's quite prominent feature for around 100 kilometers along the strike, which means perpendicular to that surface. And so it's very prominent feature. And the question is, would possibly in that earthquake, it was 44, would possibly in that earthquake that splay fault did activated, was it activated during the earthquake? The earthquake, subductions and earthquakes usually start deep and go up and either towards one side or both sides. But anyway, the rupture probably arrived from here. Here, the question is, did it go along that splay fault or not? Did it possibly continue along this? We do not think so. So the question is, would such a splay fault be activated? Okay, we did some theoretical and computational modeling, and this is the general situation. Here is the rupturing fault. There is a branch. The branch does exist. Here is continuation of the main fault. There is a branch angle between this. So this is given geometry. And here is the direction of maximum stress field. And what is important is that angle between the main fault and the direction of stress field. And what we think is also controlling if the branch is taken or not is the rupture velocity at the branching point. And we were using, in the modeling, we were using slip weakening models of frictional failure. Well, okay, I shall not be discussing this. This was discussed before. Now we looked at what is perspective from singular elastic crack theory on the expected importance of rupture propagation speed at the branch junction. So just two things you could take out of that. The continuous line is the Coulomb stress, and it is here. Here is the ahead, the direction ahead of the main fault, and this is left and right as here in degrees. So what you see for very low, this is very low rupture speed, the stress concentration is really ahead of the rupture. These are pictures for higher and higher rupture speed, and at quite high rupture speed, you clearly see, but it happens earlier, that the highest stress intensity is not anymore ahead of the main rupture, but on both sides, hearing both sides, definitely on one side. So the point is that the rupture actually, once it has higher speed, this is the limiting Rayleigh speed we are looking at mode 2 cracks, rupturing cracks. The point is that the quicker is the rupture, the more it wants to go off the plane. So here is what is the importance of the direction of the S maximum, which is the angle between the press stress and the main fault. This is psi. So here it is high, pretty high, 56 degrees. And here it is shallow press stress angle. And the steep press stress angle would favor the branching towards the extensional side, and shallow press stress angle would really favor branching towards compressional side. This is the most preferred direction. These numbers are related to particular dynamic friction coefficient that we were using in this. So, okay, now we will look again at at these pictures, and actually I discussed that when you have the small angle between the direction of stress field and the fault, you have possibly the dynamic branching towards your compressional side. This is thrust fault. And here, this is right lateral fault. You have steep angle around 60 degrees. This side is around 60 degrees. And you would have rather the branching towards the extensional side, which is the case here. So the field cases kind of seem in agreement with what we were thinking. here is, so with numerical modeling, we produced kind of a matrix of possibilities. Namely, we looked at different inclinations. This is high and then intermediate and then low inclination of stress field to the fault. And you see how the preferred quadrant for rupture is changing. We changed the rupture velocity, and this we achieved by nucleating the rupture in different distances from the branching point. And we had different, well, four geometries of branches that the rupture would meet. And these are these four here. So, and here are the results of numerical simulations. So what is light gray was not taken by the rupture. So what is dark black is really where the rupture went. So you see here that for the pretty steep angle between the stress field and the rupture would completely neglect the branches to the left. It would not take them. It would take the branches to the right, which is to the extensional side. And the rupture in each time had these four possibilities. And sometimes the rupture would continue along the main fault as well and then stop after some distance. And sometimes it would go on both main fault and the branch as well. So we produced, well, a bunch of these simulations. 45 is not very interesting. It's okay, this is more interesting, it's more shallow. So this is smaller direction between the stress field and the fault. And you see the results of simulations. So some branches were taken and then not fully progressed to, maybe to the last one. This is most shallow angle, 13 degrees. And you see that now the rupture would choose going to the compressional side and would never go to the extensional side. So these are numerical simulations. And then we did some additional numerical simulations concerning particular cases that I was showing you before. So for example, this is a simulation for San Fernando. We were, so we remember that. And we did simulation for with parameters which were close to these real parameters, but not completely identical. So this is the case which was the closest to that particular situation. This is for 0.8 of shear rupture velocity. So this is pretty quick rupture. Actually, there are some estimates. I do not remember numbers. This was rather quick rupture, and then it did slow down on that branch. And here is the particular simulation for the case of Kettleman Hills. So this is a shallow angle between the stress field and the fault. And here is the case for two different rupture velocities. And you see that in each time it would go to the compressional side. We don't know, as I mentioned, if this did break dynamically, but it could have as well as our simulations suggest, and as aftershocks suggest, actually. Okay, in this case, this is quite interesting, as it is subduction zone. So here are different simulations for that particular value of psi, the angle between the between the stress field and the fault, and for different rupture velocities. And what we see, it doesn't matter actually with what rupture velocity the rupture front would arrive here, it would probably take the splay fault. Now, it has a meaning for maybe many other places on Earth where there are these splay faults. Namely, practically, it means that if there is an availability of a splay fault, it probably would be taken dynamically. This is what our numerical results suggest. And it has an importance because here a tsunami could be generated, of course. And it's a difference if this rupture would go further and kind of die somewhere and produce much less tsunami, or if it would follow that splay fault up to the surface and produce much bigger. So actually it has a meaning. Unfortunately, these structures, these splay faults, could be found with additional seismic work. So they are not always known. Now, a more detailed picture. This is again Denali that Eric was showing. But now we are interested in why the rupture went into Pochumda when it could continue on Denali. It could just go straight. So here is the simulation for this direction. It is still it is actually outside the proposed number of real direction of stress field at that branch point. I shall go to that. So this is a simulation. It's the rupture would take the branch. Okay, yes, parameters for branching parameters for this. So different data, some seismic, some geological observations suggest different numbers for the direction between the stress field and the Denali fault. So as you see, none of these numbers actually is 70. They are higher. And here are estimates of rupture velocity at the branching. They are not very well constrained, and well, the fault branching fault is most trivial. You just measure on the map. Now, here are the simulations, some simulations for Denali, for that branch. So here are the parameters. So this is a little bit too little as concerns the angle between the stress field and the Denali fault. This is the rupture velocity for this simulation, and well, the fault is the branch is the branch. This was trivial. Now, what you could see here is is what happened. Okay, if the Denali did break, it would be shown. It is shown by black line, and what is shown by gray line is when Pochumda did break. So these are different moments of simulation. You see, Pochumda is starting to break, then it breaks, and it goes even more. So the branch is capturing completely the rupture. And here is for higher, here is a simulation for higher rupture velocity, which I mentioned is not well constrained. And you see that here the Denali breaks a little bit as well. That is the black line here is present. So gray is Tochunda breaks, but here Denali breaks as well. So in one of our simulations, Denali did break a little bit too. Now, in the next panel, we will see what if that angle is 80, because it's the data were different. So with the direction very steep, the Denali fault actually does not break, and Tochunda does break. So practically, it was no brainer for the rupture, which was reaching the Tochunda fault. It knew very well that it has to go on Tochunda. Now we did a simulation for intersonic incident rupture speed, just to be on the safe side. What if it was running so quickly? And Tochunda is taken as well. So we don't know if that super shear rupture velocity, when it turned back into subrayleigh, if it did. Okay, now here we go again into simulations of that branching, and we see that in each case, this is for 56, the real angle is 60 degrees, but it's small difference for all velocities, both the main fault ruptures and the branch is rupturing as well. Okay, so which indeed did happen, that is the rupture did branch and did continue as well. I want to make a quick comment here that on both Johnson Valley, on the right side, on the east side only, and on Homestead Valley, there are damage features or beginning branches which started and didn't make it. But they are on that side of Johnson Valley and on this side of Homestead Valley. Johnson Valley ruptured that way and Homestead Valley ruptured that way. It means that possibly there are quite clear signs between the damage of fault damage and the rupture directivity. Now I shall not touch on this, but there are many questions related to the existence of small branches and how do they affect the rupture along the main fault. And now here we will discuss extremely quickly the backward branching, namely that piece did rupture, this is around 4 kilometers, did rupture, this is southern end of Homestead Valley, did rupture during the fault. So the rupture came along Kickapoo Fault and we think it stopped here, it jumped and it went bilaterally on both sides, including kind of backward along that branch. Now, why it is important? From the damage point of view, directivity of a large earthquake has very high importance. That it is very important if it goes one way or if it goes the other way, depending if you have their nuclear plants or city or whatever. So the directivity of the earthquake is very important, and it probably would be good to know the past directivities of earthquakes, and it could be, perhaps there were propositions that it could be done with the use of looking at the branching situations, but this is forward branching that we discussed by now. Now, backward branching is completely forbidden by the stress field. So what we propose that such backward branch as the southern end 4 kilometers of Homestead Valley happened that way, that the rupture went on the main fault, jumped to the other fault, and then developed bilaterally. So the question is really of, could we judge from the branch, when we really don't know the process here, could we judge if the past rupture arrived from here and this was a forward branch, or like in this case we know that it was that that the rupture went that way, jumped, and then developed bilaterally. So the question is, it's probably very difficult to learn, but if you want to judge the directivity of past earthquakes from the branches, you really have to do that to know about if it was a jump and backward branch or if it was really a normal forward branch. So this is Johnson Valley, this is Kickapoo, and this is Homestead Valley, and we did model that. Here is the picture of geometry, and here are the results of the modeling. The paper has been published, I don't know, 2 weeks ago in JGR, and this is what happened. So these are pieces of the model of the of the simulation. So the rupture was going along Johnson Valley fault, then it stopped along Johnson Valley and it nucleated on Homestead Valley, and then it ruptured bilaterally along Homestead Valley. So this is what we think did happen, and if I would be lucky, I shall show the movie of this, but please ignore that line. We don't know how to remove it. And by the way, this is simulation for super shear, so it's not precisely what we really had in mind, but we could, I could do that. No, sorry. Okay, I'm not sure if we will see the movie. Okay, maybe we will. Yes. So it's developing along Johnson Valley. It jumps to. So Johnson Valley is here, and this is Homestead Valley. So it jumps from here to. It nucleates on Homestead Valley and goes bilaterally on that. Okay. Okay, I shall try to be very quick with this. How long? Okay. Eric prepared the ground for that. So we looked also at a rupture which was moving in a super shear way, at least part of that. And this is Kunlun rupture. And here there are observations of cracking. I shall show the the picture in a moment. Here is what Eric was showing. This is the super shear rupture pulse going along that fault. And we did calculate, what is important, because it was super shear rupture, what is important here, that here are these Mach fronts, and they actually theoretically go up to infinity, but in reality they probably go some number of kilometers, maybe equal to the depths of the seismogenic zone, but still a number of kilometers, maybe more than 10. So there are observations of cracking here in that area, up to 10 kilometers away from the fault zone, and we calculated Coulomb shear, which is calculated on for thrust faults, which would be perpendicular to that main fault and with some dip of 30. Anyway, here are how they would look like. And this is for two rupture velocities, 1.5 and 1.6 of shear rupture velocity. These calculations are done for that. What is important here is that this is normalized by dynamic stress drop, and the colors are, when they are kind of more vibrant here, they are pretty high by comparison with dynamic stress drop here. So the numbers are quite high. It looks like the stress field might have been inducive for this kind of structures. We calculated that for thrust faults, because what the observation is, the field observation is, I shall show how the field observation looks like. Oh, on the main fault, it is just a strike slip right lateral. Yes. Sorry. Yes, calculations are right lateral, yes. Okay, so if you want to see that, well, so, okay. It looks like it would be possible that these things would be created. Now, I have no more time for that. I shall give...
So that damage is on the compressional side of the fault?
Yes. The, okay. I shall have links here. This is the last thing. So I really have no time to go into the details, but if you would want, you could go. The text is almost ready. Maybe not yet. So in summary, we did see that strongly driven rupture on a planar fault accelerates towards its limiting speed. This is what Eric was discussing. And the higher is this speed, the more the stresses of the main fault become larger than on it. And if such failure is successful once nucleated, depends on press-stress state, and in particular on the angles between the stress state and the main fault, and in different cases, the either extensional side or compressional side is favored. And we did some simulations for higher rupture velocities as well. And what we really don't know are rupture velocities at branching points. I think these things are normally not well constrained or not known. And the backward branching is most likely achieved by as abrupt arrest on the primary fault, followed by a jump to a neighboring fault and bilateral propagation on it. And this means that the diagnosing the directivity of past earthquake could be difficult without detailed knowledge of the branching process. By the way, if you look at the Landers, I do not have a picture, unfortunately, but if you look at Landers map of what was broken, which was mapped by geologists just after the earthquake, and we know that the earthquake started in the south and go kind of north and west, but if you look at what was mapped, there are actually three prominent long branches which are backwards, and only one, this Johnson Valley branch, which is forward branch. So practically, if you would want to judge the directivity of an earthquake just based on the branches, for Landers, you would judge that it must have been going south. Thank you.
Time for a quick question.
Shout.
Okay, for posterity. The backward going branch, you showed that you had quite a few reflections after it jumped. Couldn't those be picked up seismically to see whether it was a jump or a bifurcation?
No, it was a jump. We made it, yes, a jump. But
yeah,
after,
yeah, in the simulations, but you weren't sure whether it was...
Yes, because there were waves coming back from the other end, so I think these were reflected waves.
Yeah, yeah, but could you see that seismically? You should.
I didn't look at that. I had questions to comment on that part of on the backward branch along Homestead Valley. I had questions in the past why I am so sure that it was dynamic rupture during the earthquake. Maybe it was large aftershock. Of course, nobody knows, because from the seismic data, you really could not learn at all about the dynamic rupture of southern end of Homestead Valley. But the damage pattern that I was pointing out, which is only to the western side, suggests to me that it must have been going south from Kickapoo, from the junction with Kickapoo. It must have been going south, because if not, it would have the damage on the other side.
Going back to your favorite example of the Nankai, yes, and the model for the splay fault there, one of the issues associated with subduction zones is the thought that the de Coulmont is significantly weaker than the thrust faults that rise off it, which makes it doubly confusing why it would branch off of a weaker fault zone, the de Coulmont, that would propagate forward up onto that branch. The question to you is does the variation in friction along the fault play a role in this?
Yes, it does. So perhaps it would be good to model such situation with making different conditions, frictional conditions, along the main fault, which we didn't do. So yes, it does, and perhaps further work is needed. This is kind of simple work.
Renata, you showed the solutions for propagating crack and how the stress field in front of the crack varied as a function of the propagation speed. And I'm wondering whether there are cases where one gets more pulse-like rather than crack-like behavior. And I wonder whether, does that play a role in the tendency to branch and under what conditions? Because the stress field in the front presumably is different in those two,
yes,
cases.
This would be a question to Jim, who does play with the pulse versus just running crack. But I think that because we are looking just at the fields close to the crack tip, I think that the fact that it would be a, you mean that finite length pulse propagating versus, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that it would not change the picture in front. But Jim, what is your comment? Thank you.
Last question.
I'm just curious whether one, and my naive question is, can I think of there being a uniform stress state in some mismatch of faults, or should one think of there also being some heterogeneity in between these different faults that hasn't relaxed, that can cause a sort of jumping between things?
I am sure that there are heterogeneities in the stress field. I think this is an attempt at basic understanding of branching, but in reality, this inhomogeneities in stress field could have an effect. Now, I really don't know how much how they could look like, how much direction would differ. I would assume that if it would be a difference of few degrees, it would not change the picture, if it would be more serious difference. It definitely differs with higher scale, this I know, and it changes with time as well, with geologic time practically. If you have the direction, let us say 200 kilometers from where you are, not necessarily where you are, you could approximate this by that other direction. So the scale of the inhomogeneities is definitely on the order of 100 or 200 kilometers, I'm sure of that. How smaller they are, I don't know.
So that's not something that, I mean, I have no idea how you measure stress fields within the Earth or to what degree.
It's never very good. I think it's never very precise constraint. As you did see for Denali, there was quite a variety of numbers, and it was partially coming because it was coming from different methods, for example, from small seismicity and mechanisms of small seismicity. You could calculate what the prevalent stress field is, and from so-called geologic markers. So you look at what faults are existing and what is their direction and the position on the map, etc. And this is how you could guess what is the direction of the main stress field.
Since we should probably move to the next speaker, but just to comment on the
measurements of these stress fields, there's assumptions about homogeneity of the stress field that go into these inferred measurements of the stress fields. So there's a bit of circularity about the statement that they, you know, are as homogeneous as the measurements are somewhat suggesting. So take that with a block of salt.